Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cap Bailey, and today we're going to be talking about The Legend of Zelda, a series that is debatably an RPG, but certainly has RPG roots. Specifically, I'm going to be asking Nadia and Bob what their favorite Legend of Zelda games are, and I'm going to be sharing my own, because we recently ranked the 25 best Zelda games of all time, including spin-offs and the most obscure stuff you've never heard of, including like Navi Trackers and the BS Zelda no Densetsu. So you should go check that out on the website. Joining me first to talk about his favorite Zelda is, as always, Bob Mackey.
Hello, everybody. It's good to be back on Axe of the Blood God.
I know, and welcome back. It's been a few weeks since you've been on here.
As I stammer through my introduction, that's how that's how rusty I am.
We're professionals here, don't worry. But before we get to talking about Zelda, why don't we talk really briefly about an event that you did a couple days ago. You met with John Harden from Atlas, and he showed you Odin Sphere, which is getting remade for the PlayStation 4 and the Vita. I would love to hear your impressions. They should be on the site by now. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I played the original PlayStation 2 version, and it was really one of those games that was way too ambitious for the hardware platform it was on. I mean, you could say the same thing about things like Shadow of the Colossus, but it was still pretty playable, you know, despite the frame rate drops and things like that. With Odin Sphere, some of the bigger bosses, I swear the frame rate would drop into single digits at some points. Like, it was, the hardware was just like choking on that game. So seeing everything in a new, prettier form on a system that can actually handle it two generations later is like, oh wow, like this is what the game always should have looked like. This is what how the game always should have moved. It's like, it feels like finally, like, the promise of Odin Sphere is being delivered to us, because I didn't play much of the game past that first chapter because of those technical problems.
So what did you get to see during this event?
Not a whole lot, maybe like 30 minutes of gameplay, and the fundamental gameplay of Odin Sphere hasn't really changed. It is very much a kind of brawlery, beat-em-up fantasy thing. Like, that's kind of what VanillaWare does. I mean, it's very much like in the vein of Dragon's Crown. You just go through these enemy encounters. You, of course, it's a VanillaWare game, so you eat a lot of delicious and beautifully rendered food. Yeah, I mean, if you played a VanillaWare game, they really have a certain kind of action RPG they make, and Odin Sphere is very much in that mold.
So you didn't see a whole lot. Did they show you a dungeon? Like, did they show you a specific area? Did they show you specific characters?
I did see a few characters, and if you'll forgive me, I don't have my notes in front of me. They all have, like, these bizarre fantasy names, so they don't really roll off the tongue, but...
Get on the ball, Bob. Come on.
Gwendolyn? I don't know. The Dark Knight, something like that. Some bunny character. I don't know. They're all there. I saw some new mini-bosses, which were added to sort of break up the gameplay, make some different challenges happen alongside all the brawlery stuff. And I did see some of the new skill system things they put in there, where now characters have unlockable skills and a ton of like passive, active skills and even new moves, which is really adding a lot of depth to the game, which was, I would say it was a kind of a shallow experience. And like I said, this version of the game does feel like a more fully realized version of Odin Sphere.
Shallow? Bob, Japanese RPG hater in the house.
It was a bit shallow, and I think it's because, like, my story about Odin Sphere is, and I forgive me if I'm misremembering this, because it has been 9 years, but I played it, and I beat the boss of the first world, and then the second world, you start off by fighting that boss again with a different character, and I was like, well, I think I'm done with this. And that kind of, those kind of issues are going to still be there, but that particular boss was the boss where the frame rate dropped down to like 8 frames per second. So I did not have the tenacity to struggle through that battle again with that kind of technical limitation, but this time around, I think it'll be much easier.
Bob, you're a retro connoisseur. You're like, you really enjoy older games. And at this point, Odin Sphere is an older game since it came out for the PlayStation 2, which two console generations ago, almost a decade at this point.
I believe it was 2007.
Was it 2007? I thought it might have been like 2005 even.
I'm not sure, but I'm almost positive it was 2007 though.
Well, in any case, that's almost 10 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is just one of those instances where a game can just really benefit from a remake, right? Like, there's some remakes where you're like, oh man, why are you even doing this? But in this case, like, they're fixing a game that probably didn't hold up so well.
Yeah, and I'm really impressed that I don't know what kind of archiving process Vanillaware has, or if they have a better archiving process than most other companies or publishers, but or developers rather. But I was surprised that everything had been replicated so perfectly, at least according to my memory. Like I said about Twilight Princess, I think it's like the game is how you remember it, not how it actually looked. So they've done an excellent job in preserving those assets and bringing them to a new generation, I think.
Are they just using the old assets and then up-resing them, or are they creating whole new assets?
I don't know the process, and John wasn't really privy to that either. I can ask George Kamatani, I think his name is, at some point, but it might take a long turnaround to get answers from him. But it looks like more than a simple upscaling. From what I'm guessing the assets were probably created at a higher resolution and then down-res for the PS2.
Okay.
But that's just conjecture. But in any case, it looks like a PS4 game. It is just drop-dead gorgeous in the tradition of Vanillaware, like the best 2D graphics you've ever seen in your life.
How does it animate?
It does have that kind of puppety animation. It is a Vanillaware game. The animation is kind of like that, you know, kind of like a whole bunch of moving parts, like sort of like moving and undulating. But it looks really good in motion, I think.
Yeah, just recently I went to an Atlas event and I saw Grand Kingdom. Are you familiar with that?
I am not, actually. Is that related to Grand Knights Historia or something?
Grand Knights History, I think
History,
that's what it's called.
Is that related?
Sort of. It's by the same designer.
I thought so, yeah.
The only reason I bring it up is because that designer, I guess, started at Vanillaware and was mentored by, like, George Kamitani and stuff like that. And his game has a really similar look to it. It's a strategy game, though. It's kind of Valkyria Chronicles in 2D. It's cool. Interesting. You, like, the overworld, you move around on a... you move around on kind of a set grid, I guess. Like, it's almost like a board game. And then you fight individual encounters, and then you have an army on one side, you have an army on the other. You have a certain number of action points where you can move them around, and then you can shoot. It's for the PlayStation 4, and I think maybe the Vita. I don't have that info in front of me right now. Yep, it's going to be for the PlayStation Vita. It looks gorgeous, and it's kind of in that similar vein where you're like looking at it and going, God, this game is so gorgeous. So a couple of really fantastic looking Japanese RPGs coming from kind of similar sources this year. Mm-hmm.
And I do want to say that if you are put off by my Dragon's Crown comparison, I mean, these conversations have already been had years ago. We don't need to have them now. But you could say Dragon's Crown was a little self-indulgent in its the way it interpreted its characters in a way. I mean, look at how they're designed. I feel like if that will throw you off, Odin Sphere is a little more, I will say, dignified and not as Frank Frazetta-y. It's a little more classical in its style. So if you're thinking it's a little exploitative or self-indulgent, whatever adjective you want to use, it's not like that that aspect of Dragon's Crown. I just don't want people who didn't like Dragon's Crown to be scared away from Odin Sphere if they're new to it.
I actually liked Dragon's Crown.
I don't want to play it in front of my girlfriend, so that's kind of a deciding factor.
I mean, I suppose I understand that, but I thought that it got a bad rap a bit because of the art and because in the back half of the game you have to do a lot of grinding.
Yeah.
But it's a fun co-op brawler, and I feel like he learned a lot from his experiences with Odin Sphere and Princess Crown. And Muramasa the Demon Blade as well. And I just the fact that there were route splits in the middle of the dungeon, and they were really distinct and interesting, and each dungeon kind of had its own story. Like, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Odin Sphere, I think, is much more... it's less of a Frank Frazetta, like, Conan the Barbarian kind of thing, and more of a, like, classic, like, German fairy tale with where everybody dies, basically. But it's great. Like, I can't wait to play it again, and I can't wait to play a version of it that is... feels complete, feels like what they wanted to do but couldn't a decade ago.
I'm really looking forward to it as well, especially because I didn't get a lot of time with the original Odin Sphere. And it sounds like they're just overhauling it from top to bottom. Not just the graphics, but the systems, making the gameplay a lot more diverse and less repetitive. It's basically a whole new game, almost a sequel in some ways. So I think that... It is nice to see a game that got a lot of hype back in the day, but ultimately didn't hold up, getting another chance to shine.
Yeah, it's a good choice, and I hope we see more more games like this, more productions like this, where it's like, we couldn't do what we wanted to do, but now that we can, let's do it. Like, I really like that kind of a remake.
Yeah, the PlayStation 2, like, it was a good system, but at the end of the day, it was... kind of limited in all, especially in the 2D category, right?
Oh, for sure.
So, yeah. In any case, let's move on to Zelda. As I already said, we did a top 25 list of all the best Zeldas, but just because we voted for a game to be the best, which we voted Link to the Past to be the best, that doesn't mean that it's our favorite. We all have our sentimental favorites in particular.
I'm getting harassed on Twitter about some of the choices.
Oh, are you?
Not harassed. People are like, I can't believe this is better than this. I'm like, hey, listen, we all voted in different ways, and that's how it shook out. I don't agree with all the stuff, but I think it's a fairly reasonable ranking that we came up with.
Democracy, everybody.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
It just
doesn't work.
If you're quite wondering about our methodology, I basically put all of the games up there and said, okay, rank them from 1 to 25. And then when everybody was done, I averaged out the rankings for each game, and that was the final list. So that's what we came up with. And the one time we came up with an actual, like, exact tie, and you'll forgive me, I don't remember which game was tied. I picked the one that had the highest ranking overall, like the top ranking, ended up getting the nod. So it more or less reflects the choices that the team made. So
yeah, wholeheartedly, I believe Link to the Past is the best expression of Zelda, and that is why every Zelda game uses it as the foundation. Even though it is sort of an enhancement of the original, I feel like it really figured out what Zelda should be, and then that's why the succeeding games have taken that tack, the same tack.
Yes, I also agree. The only thing, like, looking back, I'm surprised Hyrule Warriors ended up so low.
I'm really not. I mean, either you like Musou games or you don't.
We have the one who voted low on Hyrule Warriors.
Yeah, I think I did, but it's just like, it's a different experience. That's not the Zelda experience. You don't go to Hyrule Warriors for the Zelda experience, and that's what I took into consideration when we were voting. In fact, I said we shouldn't include it because I don't consider it to be a Zelda game. It does not progress like a Zelda game. It is just pure Musou combat, but I was overruled, so I downranked it out of pure vengeance.
Hey man, if we're going to include Link's crossbow training and like...
That's in the timeline though, right?
I don't know. Is it? It must be.
Somebody probably put it in there somewhere.
In any case, yeah. I also agree with Link to the Past being the best Zelda, though playing Twilight Princess has given me a renewed appreciation for Ocarina of Time. It's weird. Like, Ocarina of Time has gotten, even though it's consistently ranked among the best games ever made, it's gotten a lot of backlash, I guess, because there are people who are like, I don't get the love. I like was kind of bored with it. And I'll admit, like, back in the day, Ocarina of Time, it took me a long time to beat that game. Like, I played it on the N64, got stuck in the water temple, kind of dropped it. And then finally in 2004, I got the Master Quest version for the GameCube, and I beat it then. So it was like, okay, all right, I have finished Ocarina of Time. And I played it on the 3DS as well. And it was all right on the 3DS, but I think that's the kind of game that you want to play in the big screen. But in any case, I found that it was a little slow at the time, and I couldn't wait to become an adult, which to my mind was when the adventure really got started. And I thought that it borrowed a little too much from Link to the Past. But in retrospect, like, the things that jump out at me about Ocarina of Time is, A, it's way tighter than, like, any other 3D Zelda. And that includes Wind Waker. That includes Twilight Princess.
In terms of pacing?
I mean, it's just not padded out. Like,
exactly,
It feels like it has the right number of dungeons. There's no, like, stupid fetch quest for the most part. Though, I mean, there's a whole fetch sub-quest that you can do if you want to get the big Goron sword. Right. But
no, you're totally right, Kat. We just did an episode of Retronauts about Ocarina of Time, and I'm sure your listeners would love to hear it. It's on US Gamer. But yeah, that was one of the things I pointed out, just the sense of economy in that game. I feel it was born out of necessity, but you are literally in your first dungeon in 15 minutes. Twilight Princess, I believe it takes like 4 to 5 hours for that to happen. It is excruciating.
More like 2 hours, but I guess it takes a while.
If you know where you're going. I totally forgot where I was supposed to go when I started playing through it again. That could be on me, but it still takes entirely too long.
Yeah, it's doing stuff like, okay, here's a fishing pole. Go fish for the cat. Okay, you got a thing for the cat. Well, the kids have been kidnapped by a monkey.
Oh, wait, no. Herd goats once. Oh, now herd the goats again. You'll never have to do this again in the game for any reason, but just do it.
But you're like herding those goats.
Yeah.
Look, I don't want to slag on Twilight Princess too much, but
yeah, like, I wish there was a version of the 3D Zelda games that would be like, here are just the dungeons. Just play the dungeons, have fun. I wish there was like a weird remix or director's cut version. I would play Skyward Sword again if it was just the dungeons, because nothing is better to me than a Zelda dungeon. That is like the perfect expression of a video game to me.
Twilight Princess's dungeons are really good, and honestly, Ocarina of Time's dungeons are excellent. The other thing that jumped out at me, aside from that sense of economy, as you were just describing it, Bob, was just the sheer scale of the game for an N64 game. I mean, that was a big game. And this was before GTA came out. It was a good 5 years before GTA came around. And open world games were starting to come into their own. I think, like, MMORPGs were on the rise with Ultima Online and a couple years later, EverQuest. But people weren't really used to that massive degree of freedom in 3D, and it was a huge accomplishment. So it feels weird to go to bat for a game that is consistently lauded so much, but there was a weird amount of Ocarina of Time hate in our comments, so I felt obligated to say it. But in any case, Bob, what's your favorite Zelda? What's your sentimental favorite?
If you know me and everything I've written for the past entirety of my life, you would know that it's Majora's Mask. Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask. Which
the consummate hipster pick. Oh, I expect nothing less from you, Bob.
And now everybody loves it because us hipsters have been pushing for it for 10 years, 15 years. I feel like all I heard about that game were complaints until the 3DS version. I'm not trying to say I liked it first, but I actually like that the tide has turned. And I think it's because people have been wanting a different Zelda experience, a different 3D Zelda experience, and that is really the only different one. And now that we really haven't had any deviations, it's become much more appreciated since 2000, for sure.
When was the first time you played Majora's Mask?
I played it in 2000 when it came out.
Okay. Well, what did you think of it at the time?
I totally fell in love with it. I was not even fatigued by Zelda's, you know, formula, because it was still fairly fresh at that point. But I was like, oh, cool. Like, you can do a different thing with a Zelda game. Everything was shaken up. Like, the dungeons didn't have items in them. The items were in the field. The dungeons had arrows in them. There was the time limit. There was, the whole circular system and everything. I was like, wow, like, you can do... I hope they do something different with every Zelda game. This is great. And they didn't. But, it still stands out to me as, like, a way to shake things up while still retaining the core elements of Zelda. And I'm hoping the Wii U one will do things in a different but similar way, if that makes sense.
So, interestingly enough, my girlfriend was the one who beat it first. Because when I was in college, a friend of ours lent us his N64. and copies of Majora's Mask and Ocarina of Time. And she played through the entirety of Ocarina of Time, did literally everything, loved it. That was the game that made her fall in love with Zelda. She could never get into Link to the Past, by the way, because it was too combat focused and she just wanted to solve puzzles. And she felt she could get around that in Ocarina of Time. Majora's Mask, she also liked, but she was stressed out by the time limits. She didn't feel like she could explore at her own, kind of at her own whim, I suppose. But she liked the mask collecting mechanics.
Yeah, the masks are really cool. And I will say, like, once you learn the song of slowing time, which you can pick up super early in the game, you're given more than enough time to do whatever you need to do. Like, once you unlock that dungeon, you can just restart the cycle, and then you'll have, like, I don't know, like, the dungeons aren't that big, and I found that, I understand that insecurity, but I feel like they were more than fair in giving you enough time to do what you need to do in that game.
I just remember, like, watching her stand in, like, a house at some point, waiting for something to happen, and meanwhile, the moon is about to crash into the world.
Yeah.
And it's actually, like, starting to, like, flame up and everything. But she's like, no, I have to do this one thing before I can rewind time.
Yeah, some of the more interesting events happen on that third day when everything is going to shit. So it can be really tense, but that also makes it fun. You're like, what's going to happen next? Like, and, like, just part of that doomsday scenario is Link, there's no character to Link. All the characters in the townspeople, and it is so fun just watching their attitudes change from day to day as they begin to realize they are going to die. It's like an examination of, like, mortality in a very mature way that you would not expect from Zelda.
Oh, that is interesting. And this was at the point, well, with Link's Awakening in particular, it feels like they started to kind of examine these. They started to get more ambitious with their storytelling, I suppose I would say, in the sense that they would play around with, like, psychological themes and, well, this island never really existed. And now in the case of Majora's Mask, the like, contemplating your own mortality and that kind of thing. And am I wrong to feel like Aonuma, how long has Aonuma been involved with the series?
Since Ocarina of Time, but actually all of those weird and odd choices about, like, psychological themes and just strange and odd, like, decisions to make in the game, I think it's from Twin Peaks, actually. Takashi Tezuka, who directed Link's Awakening and A Link to the Past, really loves Twin Peaks, and he made Link's Awakening basically the Twin Peaks of the Zelda universe. And I think all the succeeding games have picked up on Link's Awakening's weirdness, and that's why the Zelda games, I feel, have a really dark sense of humor to them and a lot of odd and weird characters that weren't really there before.
Mm. So, and Majora's Mask, I think the thing that really stands out about it as well is just the fact that it takes a particular mechanic in Ocarina of Time, which was being able to rewind time, like, to move around in time, and plays with it and does really interesting things. And honestly, had we seen anything like Majora's Mask at that point, where you had, like, a very set time frame and that you were trying to manipulate events by, like, I guess changing things and seeing how you could make things different?
You know what? I don't know. I have to be missing something, but I don't really know. But I will say, like, strangely enough, the new Hitman game really reminds me of Majora's Mask, because it is very similar in that you are in these environments where things are progressing regardless of whether or not you're there. And in order to master these environments, you have to see them from different angles over and over again and just get an understanding of the reality. It's sort of like a Groundhog's Day thing. I'm pretty sure a game had to do the same thing before Majora's Mask, but I can't think of anything offhand, and I know I'm missing some obvious examples. But yeah, it still stands out to me as one of the more interesting systems in a video game.
That was a nice little, like, plug for your Hitman review,
oh,
by
yeah.
the way.
I have Hitman on the brain, by the way. So
you really like that game.
It's super great. It's Hitman could be, like, one... I mean, it has the potential to be like, a tasteless and lousy experience, but... just interviewing the creative director of that studio, and man, we are way off topic, but I just feel like they really know what to do with this series, and they know how to make it smart and tongue-in-cheek, and it is just, it's more of an adventure game now, which I like. It's very strange, but I hope it does well.
That is interesting. Well, we rated Majora's Mask at number 2 on our list. So,
oh man, I forgot it was number 2.
It's actually ahead of Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I don't remember the exact voting, but I don't know, Majora's Mask is just seems really well regarded by everybody on the staff, and I feel like it wasn't exactly a black sheep until this point, but you're right. The narrative around it really seemed to shift from, man, remember Majora's Mask? That was weird, to, wow, Majora's Mask is one of the most ambitious and interesting and underrated Zelda games ever made.
Yeah, and I don't know. I really want to see the Wii U Zelda make a shift to being slightly less epic, although it won't, because I feel like one of Majora's Mask's greatest assets or greatest elements is that it's not an epic adventure. Your main quest, you're not like saving, well, I guess you are saving the world, but the most important part of your quest is helping people with their everyday lives, like making them happier. And those are the stories that are still the most resonant to me today, the most memorable to me today, like reuniting a married couple, you know, just helping people with their lives before they die. I feel like just those smaller personal stories are much more meaningful than like saving the world or saving the princess or whatever. And I hope we see more of that in the Wii U version.
Yeah, taking, I guess, going back to Twilight Princess, which tried to go really, really epic.
Exactly.
I think you were comparing it to Lord of the Rings, like that game had Lord of the Rings on the brain.
Yeah, I mean, I called it, it's not exactly fair. I said it had Lord of the Rings envy, but it was Lord of the Rings was inescapable from the early to mid-2000s. There is no way it could not have influenced Twilight Princess, and I see it in the enemy designs. I see it in the world. It just feels like a very, very much whoever worked, I mean, the artists, the designers, they obviously were seeing Lord of the Rings, taking influences from it, you know, trying to make Zelda more of that Tolkien-esque adventure.
But it had some of the best set pieces in the entire series.
I agree, yeah.
Like fighting the guy and the pig on the bridge and chasing him around on your horse. That was cool.
Yeah, that definitely felt like a Lord of the Rings thing to me. And
so much so.
That's not me detracting from it. I think that that's one of the ways they borrowed from that that movie series in a good way.
I had some really good dungeons too. How far are you into Twilight Princess HD?
I played a bit of it when I was sick, and by a bit I mean like 4 hours, but I am just up to the point where they're letting me out of the starting area. So I'm so excited to get to a dungeon, a real dungeon.
Oh, okay. Wow, yeah. Dang. So you're not even a wolf yet?
No, I've done all the wolf stuff, and I believe like the first dungeon you encounter is in that first forest area, if I remember correctly. Yeah. I'm just at that point, I think. I do want to play more, but again, that opening is such a bummer, and it's kind of disheartening, and you just kind of, it's kind of like an eating your vegetables moment in Twilight Princess. Like, I can get to the yummy dessert if I eat this broccoli or whatever, so, yeah.
The second dungeon, I'd forgotten how good that second dungeon is in that game.
I was really blown away by the first dungeon when I played it, because I think they knew the type of person who'd be playing that game, and it wasn't small, it wasn't compact, it had many, many levels, many layers, and it was like pretty big, if I recall correctly. I just remember being kind of like, wow, this is the first dungeon? I'm in for a treat with this game.
I remember thinking when it came out that they wanted to kind of rectify the mistakes of Wind Waker, or the perceived mistakes, which was that Wind Waker was pushed out, that it had the fewest number of dungeons in the series, so it felt kind of unfinished and they were recycling too much material. And they took an entire extra year with Twilight Princess to put in as much extra just material and these like lovingly crafted and gigantic dungeons and a bigger world. And in hindsight, it feels like padding. But at the time, like, oh my god, that was so exciting to play this just massive, delicious feast of a game.
It's funny to just think of how we approach games has changed in the past 10 years. Like, I think we welcomed that kind of padding a decade ago. Even as short as a decade ago, that was like, oh, cool, more content. Now I think our lives are so much different. The way we get content is so different that we just want things to cut to the chase, really. And I'm hoping, Twilight Princess, I'm sorry, Skyward Sword had an equally slow opening. And I'm hoping Zelda Wii U seems to be, from what they're saying, it seems to be an answer to the criticisms Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword Sword had. So I'm hoping they do fix those pacing issues with this newest game. If it comes out on the Wii U, I don't know. I still don't know if that's going to happen.
I guess we'll know at E3, won't we?
Oh, yeah. That's going to be the deciding factor. If it's not at E3, I really doubt it's going to be on Wii U.
I can't believe that it's not coming out this year. I mean, if they don't release it this year, what else have they got for the Christmas?
It could be a stealth NX launch. They could just be like, okay, please don't use these words against me in the future, but E3 could be like, this is the NX. It's coming out in November. Get ready. Here's a new Mario game, and now Zelda's going to be on this. So
Mario Galaxy 3. Let's go.
Although, I'm not sure if the Mario team still makes Zelda games. It's been like that forever, and that may explain why we haven't seen a Mario game since Super Mario 3D World U or whatever the hell. The whole naming convention confuses me, but you know what I mean, the Wii U Mario World game.
I'm ready for another Mario Galaxy, or at least another 3D Mario.
Me too. I wonder if Nintendo will have the confidence. In doing research for Mario 64, I remember reading Miyamoto or Tezuka or someone saying that, like, ever since we made 3D Mario games, our audience has dropped off precipitously. Like, there's a certain group of people who does not want to play a 3D Mario game. So I feel like they've been like Mario 3D Land. God, what the hell is the name of that game? I'm looking at it.
Mario 3D World.
Mario 3D World?
There's New Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
And they launched with New Super Mario Brothers for the Wii U.
Right. So, 3D Mario World.
Yes.
Okay.
Super Mario 3D World.
God, I hate that naming convention. Anyways, that game was not a 3D Mario game. It was like an isometric game. And the 3D parts were extremely limited. You were usually just running in a straight line. And I think that's the kind of compromises they're willing to make to retain that Mario audience. But I would love a Galaxy 3. I would like to see them take more risks with Mario.
Well, maybe we will. All right, Bob, thanks for dropping by. And oh, by the way, everybody should go check out your cover story,
which came out
earlier this week. It's an oral history of Day of the Tentacle. And even if you haven't played that game, you should totally check it out because it's a really fantastic interview.
Yeah, and you should play the game when it releases later this month on PC and PS4. It's, in my opinion, the best LucasArts adventure game. And I could justify that if you give me my own little symposium.
Have you already done that in a podcast?
I think I've done that several thousand times in my life. So, yeah, it's recorded somewhere.
Well, GDC's next week, so maybe you can just, elbow somebody off the podium and be like, all right, let's talk about the LucasArts adventure games.
No one cares about your database software. Get out of here.
Exactly. All right, Bob, thanks for dropping by, and we'll talk to you later.
Always a pleasure.
All right, we're back here now with Nadia Oxford, and we're going to talk about her favorite Zelda game. But before we do that, really quickly, Nadia, you wrote a news story about a new Pokemon strategy game for mobile. Could you elaborate on that?
From what I can, because it's all the information's in Japanese and it's translated. I got my translation from Paul. Kind of like a strategy board game, like in the vein of Go. Which, of course, is hugely popular in Japan, but not too many people in the West play it, as I understand.
I'm going to say that it's virtually unknown in the U.S.
Well, the term Atari comes from the game Go.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's kind of like Checkmate, I think, but otherwise I know very little about Go, and I don't know a whole lot about the game itself, to be honest. I would like to see it come to the West, though, because I don't know a lot about Go.
I mean, my knowledge of Go extends to reading Game Over.
Yes, me too.
And it's a dramatization of, what was it, the Dutch guy who brought over Tetris. Yes, this is me remembering names.
Yeah,
playing against Hiroshi Yamauchi. Yeah, and this Dutch entrepreneur also enjoyed it, and so that's how they built up their business relationships, or... supposedly Game Over dramatized things a little bit, but he definitely loved Go. That was his thing. So, probably. In any case, all right, so Pokemon Go, but not the Pokemon Go that we know of.
Yeah, although the company that's helping the States, so we might see it after all.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm playing Pokken Tournament right now.
Oh, how is it?
so far, in a preview sense, it is a fighting game that I'm playing.
Well, that about covers it.
I will say that Bandai Namco has been clearly... It's faithful to the property.
Yeah.
In the sense that the monsters, like, all right, look right, they feel right, they're using the attacks that you would expect them to use, like Shadow Punch and Shadow Ball and
so there
Fire Pokemon. Blast.
There are Pokemon and they are fighting.
Some interesting choices in there.
Yeah.
Some interesting choices. They've got Charizard, Blaziken, and Sceptile for some reason.
Really?
Which, that's fine. They're starters. Suicune. Was it Weevil?
I know the one you're talking about. But I can't remember the exact name.
Yeah, he's like the little ice guy. Ice cat. And Suicune, it's a water legendary from Gold and Silver.
Oh, that one. I never knew how to pronounce his name.
A very random instance of Chandelure, which is the ghost fire type from Black and White.
Huh, that's odd.
I would have liked Haxorus to be in there, to be honest. That would have been kind of interesting. Make him a grapple. Haxorus is this like big monster that like grabs onto you. Or it's a big monster that looks kind of like a T-Rex, has little stubby arms.
Yeah.
Very high attack.
It's funny because like some of the ones you're mentioning, they don't have arms at all. It's like, how are you fighting, guys?
Well, some of them are on the ground running.
You can run into the knees and just kind of topple you over.
Like Suicune is like on, he's like a dog. He's on all fours. So. Yeah. And he can shoot like ice beams and stuff. Yes. Yeah. And there's Pikachu, of course, and Lucario, of course. There's some notable omissions, but you can unlock a lot of accessories.
Like little hats?
Little hats.
Aw. Well, that's all that counts, I guess.
Well, not for your character, not for the Pokemon themselves, but for your, like, avatar.
Oh, what the heck? I want to put a hat on Pikachu.
I like customizing my avatar.
True.
Any game that lets me customize my avatar, like, immediately gets a thumbs up for me.
That's true. I can't resist customizing avatars to begin with, to be honest with you.
Anyway, you can expect my review of that on Tuesday. Let's talk about Zelda.
Yes, let's.
All right, Nadia, what's your favorite Zelda?
Well, I had to think about it after you warned me that I'd be talking about it. I think I'm going to go with A Link to the Past. And
okay, so you're going with the number one game on our list?
The safe option. But I had to really think about it, and the reason why, and I think this is fair, is because it is the one Zelda game I can go back to over and over and over again without getting tired of it.
And when was the last time you went back to it?
A few months ago, probably. But I will be getting it on Virtual Console once it hits the 3DS. And I think part of that is because, like, I find the intro very stirring. Like, the opening with the rainstorm... And you go into the castle, and you can hear the raindrops on the castle roof. It's just really, really well done.
It was really cinematic.
It really is, and it really gets you in the mood. It's like, oh boy, I'm going to save a princess and go on an adventure. And I was thinking about it because up until now, I would have said, you know what, my favorite is Ocarina of Time. But I found that last time I tried to go back to Ocarina of Time, I didn't really get very far. And I think that's just because there's been so many Zelda releases since where there's more to do, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Like, I know a lot of people don't like Twilight Princess, but I do love the fact that the overworld is so busy. Like, I can ride on horseback and beat up enemies, whereas in Ocarina of Time...
And grab bugs?
Yeah, you can grab bugs, that's very important. But in Ocarina of Time, if you're riding across the overworld, there's not really much to do.
No, it's true. Well, yeah. It's still a big game. It's still a lot to discover. There are Poes to collect.
That's true. There are lots of Poes. But not so many, like, Lord of the Ring ripoff enemies to hit with swords. So Twilight Princess wins in that regard.
We were talking about this in the previous segment, actually.
And
I was just reflecting that Ocarina of Time's scale was just insane for an N64 game that came out at that time. And it was really cool that you could see a thing on the horizon, like Death Mountain, and you could go to it.
Yeah.
You'd be like, what the heck is that? You go to it, and you're like, wow. And of course, Ocarina of Time established so much of what was to follow
Absolutely. Like, some people say, oh, it's overrated. I would not say that at all. Like, I would say it's one of the best Zelda games, just not one of my favorites, you know?
Well, let's go back to Link to the Past really quickly. Sure. I totally agree with you, actually. When I remember back in, like, 1993, 1994, when the Super Nintendo was still dominant, mm-hmm. just being blown away by those rain effects.
Yeah, and they're thinking, still really nice.
I mean, thinking, oh, my God, that looks amazing. And I never, it was definitely something that I could never see on the Nintendo. Mm-hmm. It was so cinematic and cool. And then, of course, you go down into the tunnel and you find your dad who, or your uncle or something.
Some guy
who's like on the verge of death, and he gives you his sword. And then you go upstairs. Into the palace, and you hear this like crash of cymbals. Yeah. And suddenly you're listening to this amazing, epic stereo music.
Yeah.
Being pumped through the Super Nintendo's sound chip. And in 1993, that was just,
it was
wow.
It really was.
Yeah.
And I also adore A Link Between Worlds, but the one thing that disappoints me about it is it doesn't have that stunning start to it.
That's true. How does A Link Between Worlds start?
Unfortunately, it kind of starts with you having to like do a fetch quest to get the sword. So it's a bit slow. It's a fantastic game in every other right, but I think Link to the Past hedges it out just because of that intro, if nothing else.
I know, that's actually a good point, because and it does such a great job of establishing what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need a ton of text or anything.
No.
And it sets you loose in the world, like, pretty fast.
It does. It's like you have your uncle telling you, you know, there's a storm going on, and he says, stay in the house, and you just know there's something bad going on.
And then you step out, and when you step out of the sewers, or out of the church, I should say, for the first time.
Yeah.
And that overworld music plays.
Yeah.
That's like the really awesome stereo version of the Zelda music from the original NES game. And you're just like, okay, yeah, I'm playing like the next gen version of this series.
It's pretty special.
It was pretty special. So yeah, tell me why else you like Link to the Past.
To be honest with you, like, it was probably my first top-down Zelda game. I started with 2, and then I went to 3.
Interesting, 2.
Yeah, I for the life of me, I cannot tell you why I started with 2, but I didn't play 1 for a long, long time. But I guess I just liked 3 because it had, as you say, it was cinematic. I don't think you have to be a Zelda fan to really appreciate that, that's for sure. But, of course, when you think about it, Zelda 3, all it is it's the first Zelda game kind of built up times 100 on this, like, amazing engine, amazing platform. So it was going to succeed no matter what. Because it's just a good game. It looks good. I have to admit the sprites are kind of squishy these days, but the backgrounds are just kind of, they're so big and vibrant.
Yes.
Even now, just looking at them just kind of makes me happy.
And when you go into the Lost Woods and that kind of thing, and you get lots of cool little effects, like the trees like reflecting down on the ground.
Yeah, and you go to where the Master Sword is, and it's like the little animals bounding around everywhere.
Yeah, it's super cute.
It is.
I like how elaborate and interesting the dungeons are.
Although being my first Zelda game of that breed, it stumped me like hell.
I mean, it would do that.
Because nowadays it's like, oh, light the torches. Where are you, a moron? Like, of course everyone else will light the torches. But back then I'm like, I thought, okay, there's torches on the walls. Are these the ones you're talking about? But no, they're talking about the little, like, kind of banister-looking ones.
That was me in Link's Awakening. I didn't realize I was supposed to light the torches, bomb the walls, kill all the enemies in a room, move the block to open the door.
Was that your first Zelda? Or?
It was my first Zelda.
So that would do it. Yeah, so everyone has to have that sort of initiation.
Yes, exactly. And I spent a lot of time calling the Nintendo hotline. I mean, like, what do I do? And they're like, push the block. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I just paid you $10 to tell me that and waited on the line for 30 minutes hearing advertisements for Super Game Boy.
Do they talk really slow when they finally get to you?
No. They were totally on the level and very helpful. Except in Star Tropics, where I was always trying to be like, there was this one, I was stuck in this one dungeon and I never got past it. And they were like, look for the area with the slug on it, and then there's a button underneath him. I'm like, there's no slug. So yeah, this is my Nintendo game counselor story.
But I never call them, because if you call them from Canada, you're basically looking at your life savings right there.
Oh my god, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, I don't like mobile phones in particular, but the one thing I don't miss is long distance charges.
Oh, absolutely.
But and when it comes to Link to the Past, I wrote that it kind of defines Zelda as we know it today.
Yes, absolutely.
Not just in the way that it had the three amulets and then the eight dungeons after that, but just in the fact that the original Zelda, I can't speak for Zelda 2 as much, the original Zelda was so combat heavy. Like,
yeah.
I actually compared it to Dark Souls.
That's an interesting comparison.
Oh, yeah. It's like pure exploration, doesn't tell you, doesn't show you a lot, you know, of what to do. You just have to kind of figure everything out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really combat focused. It's like those dungeons are a battle of endurance and survival more than puzzle solving and being able to keep track of. Being able to keep track of how everything connects together, whereas A Link to the Past was puzzle solving, right?
It was, and of course, puzzles in the first Zelda game, well, you're pushing blocks, and that's about it. But and maybe at the most, you have to remember where you're going and where you've been, or which wall to bomb, that sort of thing. But another thing about Link to the Past that just kind of came to mind is you don't really realize how huge it is until you get through those first three palaces. And then you're kind of blown away because you have this, you have basically the majority of the game stretching out in front of you when you get to the Dark World for the first time.
And it's so cool when you use the, when you get sent into the Dark World.
Yes.
And like the screen goes all wibbly wobbly.
Yeah.
And it plays that very particular sound effect and suddenly you're in a whole new world.
But the first time you see the Dark World too, and this is also another big score for the game's atmosphere, is you turn into a little bunny. You're helpless. You're stuck on Death Mountain, and there's this horrible storm raging, and there's this guy kicking this other guy for no reason. And it's just really intimidating, and I remember exploring Death Mountain for the first time, just being, like, so blown away by how helpless I was and how there was nothing I could do except go back. Like, it kind of gives you a preview of, like, the puzzles you can come back to. Like, you enter this one room full of spikes, and you're just like, oh my god, what is this? What do I do? Where do I go? And of course, you can't do anything with it yet. You have to come back to it. But just that one taste of what's coming is just like, goodness gracious.
And it was really cool how you had to keep the light world and the dark world straight in your mind, kind of.
Yes.
And understand, it's like, okay, if I go into the dark world here, then I... Because, see, the mirror... You have to use a... You have to find particular portals to enter the dark world.
Yeah.
But you can use the mirror to get back to the light world anytime.
Yeah.
And there are some areas in the dark world that are accessible that aren't accessible in the light world.
Yes. And I find that's kind of a thing that's popped up in other games since. I can't name any off the top of my head. I just know that I've seen the mechanic before and I think, oh, that's just like Link to the Past.
Yes. And you can see them using it in kind of later games in the sense of, well, manipulate this thing in one world and it will change in the other world.
Of course,
and it's just, and that kind of became the time traveling mechanics in Ocarina of Time later.
Yeah.
It was a really good game.
Just how, when I think about it, how many things it did first and how important that is and how ultimately I think that's what helps me make my selection of like the best Zelda, not to mention my favorite Zelda.
Hmm. What was your favorite dungeon?
In Link to the Past?
Yeah.
Shoot. You know what?
Putting you on the spot. Okay, Turtle Rock. That one's an intense one.
It was the final
dungeon.
Yeah, it's kind of intense. You definitely get the sense that you're getting closer. I will say, however, the dungeon that gave me the most problems was, and I still think this is crap, is the Harris Tower getting the Moon Pearl, where you have to walk from the wall. And go, like, backwards almost. I've never seen a puzzle like that in another Zelda game, and I don't want to.
That Harris Tower, like, I admittedly don't remember the structure of that dungeon very well. I just remember that at the top you had that big battle with the beetle.
The Moldrum, I think.
Yeah. And it would knock you off. And you had to get back up. But at the same time, like, it was so cool because you could see, like, stuff below it.
Yeah, that was a really neat effect for the SNES at the time.
So it was really cinematic and you felt like, oh my gosh, like, I'm in this huge battle. I'm about to get the third and final pearl so that I can move on to get the sword. Ugh, what a great game.
It is. And that's probably why I go back to it all the time. And I still kind of feel the excitement of, like, getting that sword and progressing to the next area.
No, I want to play it. But I don't think I'm going to play it on my 3DS. I think I'll play it on my TV.
Like the like the Lord intended?
Yeah, exactly. Because I have the GBA version, actually. It's, like, lying around somewhere. And I've played that version many, many times. And I've finished it on the Super Nintendo as well. But I sort of feel like it's the kind of game you need to play on a TV. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's such a big, beautiful cinematic game. Which I don't mean to demean the 3DS or the Vita or anything. But I just think that the Link to the Past is such an epic and cool game that it's the kind of game I want to play on TV.
Yeah, I can understand that.
And I haven't played the GBA. I've played the GBA version within the past 10 years. I have not played the original Super Nintendo version on the TV in a very, very long time. So
it'd be like kind of seeing it new all over again.
Yeah, I think so. So it's a great game. But you want to know what my favorite Zelda game is?
Which?
My sentimental favorite Zelda is Link's Awakening.
That's a very good choice, too. It's definitely up there amongst my top favorites. Have you seen the Symphony of the Goddess show?
No, I haven't.
It's very good. I've seen it a few times, actually. It's come to Toronto several times. And one time they did a suite for Link's Awakening. And, you know, they played the ending alongside, like, footage of the ending. And it's just like, I'm not going to cry.
No.
You'd be surprised how emotional those little sprites are up on a big screen.
Yeah, and hearing it in a full hearing the Ballad of the Windfish in the full symphony.
It was very good. It's a great soundtrack for the Game Boy.
I know, it's phenomenal. That game was so ambitious for a portable, for a handheld console.
They really pack it in there.
And we're not talking about, like, later on where you had very good games, but the Game Boy was such a, at the time, like, it certainly didn't stack up to the Super Nintendo in terms of power, like, in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And you would have thought that if they were going to put a Zelda game on the Game Boy, that it would be, you know, closer to maybe the original Zelda.
Yeah.
And instead, like, it holds up really well.
Yeah, I was playing it, like, I haven't played it all the way through in a while, but I kind of have a game going on my 3DS, like, on the virtual console, and I go back to it every so often, and, you know, I've been picking at it, and it's a great game.
It has this big, beautiful world. Like, the island itself, Koholint Island, was just a compelling location with the big windfish egg at the top, and it's like, what's inside there? And a great story. I mean, it was the first time that Zelda really seemed to experiment with storytelling outside of beat Ganon, save the princess.
Yeah, and it was, of course, as I just mentioned, it had some pretty compelling characters. And at the same time, despite being kind of have this sense of foreboding behind it, because, you know, it told you under no uncertain terms that if you wake up the windfish, it's all over, but you have no choice. But at the same time, it's fun, it's funny.
Exactly. And it had some really, it didn't have the intricacy of the light world and the dark world, but it still had some really good dungeons.
Yeah.
The dungeons blended together a bit more, but at the same time, you also had, like, the Eagle's Tower.
That was a pretty cool dungeon.
Where you're trying to get to the top and you're doing things like you're pushing the tower levels together.
Yeah, that's the one where you hit the supports, right? You collapse the tower almost?
Yes, yeah. Until you can reach the top.
That was a very unique way of going about that.
And then it had a side-scrolling battle with the eagle diving down at you and stuff.
Yeah.
That was a cool battle.
It's interesting how it called back to the first Zelda game in that regard. It had a lot of side-scrolling portions, whereas, you know, Zelda had a few, the original, but not too many.
Yeah, and that kind of, that element has kind of gone away from the series.
Which is too bad.
No, I agree. But it just works on so many levels, and it holds up really, really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And like they kind of solidified its status by releasing Zelda DX, which is the Game Boy Color version. So it's just a wonderful game in a lot of different ways. And I think that maybe it's not as complicated or as ambitious as, say, A Link to the Past or Ocarina of Time, but I think that it's my favorite complete Zelda experience. All right, before we go, Nadia, big fan of A Link Between Worlds?
Yes.
Best Zelda game since Ocarina?
You know what? It's up there.
By the way, this would go against our rankings, I think, because it's below Wind Waker.
Yeah, it didn't really climb the charts as high as I would have liked. I'm pretty sure I ranked it up there pretty high.
Yeah, I ranked it up there really high as well. Possibly top five.
It's kind of difficult to rank it like amongst all the Zeldas, though, because we've had so many 3D Zeldas, and Zelda really varies from game to game. But I would definitely, like, if you put me in a room full of Zelda games, it would be one of my first go-tos, and I think maybe even, like, after or before Ocarina.
All right, here's the question I ask. Which Zelda games can make you cry?
Well, I already mentioned Link's Awakening.
Link's Awakening and Link Between Worlds. Those are the two that can make me cry.
I'm trying to remember what parts of Link's Awakening are really emotional. I mean, I'm sure they were there, but it's been a long time since I played it.
Well, I mean, just the final sequence.
Oh.
Like the end? I don't want to... screw it. If you don't want spoilers, maybe you should stop listening now.
Yes.
Okay. So at the end, it turns out that the Windfish is dreaming of Koholint Island.
That's right.
And you wake him up, and you basically... And the Windfish is this big, like, cool yellow submarine type thing. And you wake him up, and as the Ballad of the Windfish is playing, because I think you're playing it on your flute, the Windfish awakens, and the island slowly disappears, and you see various scenes of the island that you've come to know and love because it's this wonderful, compelling setting slowly fade away.
Yeah, it just kind of vanishes.
And you awaken on a log of driftwood just in time to see this island that was a real place with real people, including Marin, who taught you the song, disappear.
Yeah.
And the final shot is just... And then the credits roll.
Yeah.
And it's... like... Because you've gotten to know these characters and, like, really like them, I mean, it's sad to see them go, you know? And you go, well, is this even real? Well, yeah. It made an emotional impact on me, so it must have been.
No, it did to me, too. Like I said, I saw that at Symphony of the Goddess, and, you know, seeing it up there is just like, wow, this is still really kind of sad, and not even in a bittersweet way, because I guess Link seems happy about it, because he sees the seagull and he thinks maybe it's Marin, but...
Yeah.
Other than you gain a seagull, but you lose the island.
All right, Marin, you're a seagull now.
Hooray.
Well, it's a net win for everybody. At A Link Between Worlds, like, so spoilers again, what a great reveal at the end, revealing that, Pink Bunny Guy was Zelda, was Link.
Oh, well, yeah,
which, of course, makes perfect sense.
Yes.
The guy in the bunny costume, of course he's Link.
Of course.
Oh my god.
No, that's right. I didn't forget about that part. The whole thing about, you know, Link and Ravio. That was a lot of fun. He's a fun character.
But when they make the wish, or like, I think Link and Zelda make the wish to help the other world.
Yeah.
Low Rule. It's an emotional moment. Very sweet. And I teared up a little bit. And I was like, what a great game. Oh my god, I love this game so much.
I had a really great time with it, especially since I think it was a game that people weren't sure about at first.
I was definitely not sure. I'm like, what the heck is this? How dare you, like, copy the best Zelda game ever made?
Yeah.
There's no way that it's going to be able to stand up to this. Oh, good, you're adding a gimmick where you become, like, flattened against the wall. Yeah, that's, like, a great idea for a Zelda game. Let's just add gimmicks. okay, let's reuse and bastardize content from A Link to the Past while adding in unnecessary gimmicks. And then I played it and I loved it.
Exactly. That's exactly how it went down. And, you know, bravo, because that's a risky game to screw around with.
You know, exactly. When I was playing it, it was like a feast. Mm-hmm. Like going into each dungeon, I'm like, oh, yes, I'm just going to savor this dungeon, right?
It was just a perfect balance of new and old.
And you're probably like, people are like going, geez, Kat, like, Zelda, it's not an RPG. Why are you even talking about it in this podcast? Well, it borrows enough from the RPG tradition, including dungeon crawling,
that
I feel like it's at least worth discussing, even if I acknowledge that in the traditional sense, it is an action-adventure game. You have some tools. There's a life gauge, but there's no, like, stats. Zelda 2 kind of introduces stats, but the game proper moved away from them. But it borrows enough from the tradition and it's kind of a periphery to the RPG genre, but it owes enough of a debt to it that it's worth discussing on an RPG podcast. And besides, it's my podcast. I'll talk about anything I want.
I was going to say, you don't need an excuse to talk about Zelda. Not in my company, anyway.
No, absolutely not. And I doubt most people would need an excuse to listen to a podcast about Zelda.
There you are.
But in any case, once again, if you want to go check out the rankings, the full rankings are on the website. I just spent an episode complaining about them, apparently. But no, I actually do think I am actually pretty happy with how things shook out with A Link to the Past, Majora's Mask, and Ocarina of Time being 1, yes. 2, 3. We never talked about Wind Waker, which is interesting. But so it goes, right?
Yeah. Hey, do a follow-up podcast. I'd be okay with that.
Let's talk about how Spirit Tracks is criminally underrated.
I agree. I really like that game. That was a cute little game.
It's way better than Phantom Hourglass. I hated Phantom Hourglass. Phantom Hourglass is one of the worst Zeldas I've ever played.
That bad, eh?
Yeah, like just in terms of mainline adventures, it has no spirit whatsoever. The dungeons weren't very good. I really hated the stealth sections, which you had to keep doing over and over again with a clock.
Oh, geez, just what everyone wants.
Yeah, Spirit Tracks fixed a lot of those issues. And people were mad because it limited the overworld exploration because it had a train.
Yeah, but I just like trains. I like train tracks, too. I don't know why. I just think they're cool.
The dungeons were way better in Spirit Tracks.
And I like the dungeons, yeah.
Yeah, it was way more complete. And just in general, I thought Spirit Tracks gets an unfairly bad rap.
And you know what? It came out at a time when everyone's like, oh, Zelda's so stale. I need to try something new. And they try something new, and everyone's like, this sucks.
Yeah, well, people hate new things. You know that.
Yeah, but they always ask for new things, and they hate them.
In any case, I suppose we'll be back to talk about Zelda when Zelda Wii U comes out. So we can look forward to that. But next week is GDC,
yay,
which I have absolutely no idea as to what I'm going to record for next week. There may not be an episode. I hope there's an episode. I'm actually going to go check out the one RPG-related thing I'm going to go see is Project Setsuna from Square Enix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That should be interesting.
So, if you're not familiar with it, Project Setsuna is a new game from Tokyo RPG Factory, I think is the name. It's the Square Enix RPG-focused studio that they started last year.
Mm-hmm.
So this is their first game. I'm really looking forward to seeing what this thing is actually all about, because the people in question who will be demoing the game will probably be Japanese. It might be a little harder to get them on the show, but that immediately pops into my mind. Beyond that, though, it's all VR all the time. For the most part. And we were talking about this. I was talking about this with Bob the other day. I don't think VR and RPGs mesh very well.
Not so much.
Which is too bad. Maybe in a dungeon crawling sense, but VRs focus so much on like realism and verisimilitude. Yeah, I might be pronouncing that incorrectly. And stats are meant to compensate for how do I put this? I think that's fundamentally at odds with a game that has stats.
Yeah, at least for now.
So that's too bad. But yeah, I'm gonna be putting on a lot of sweaty helmets in the next week. You're lucky you're not going, Nadia.
I can't say I'm really sad to not put on, like, you know, sweaty helmets. Not to mention, I'm not sure if my stomach could take VR yet.
Yeah, mine certainly can't. In the meantime, you should check out Stardew Valley.
Yeah, maybe I will. I think I should.
All right. Is there anything that you're playing or you want to plug, Nadia?
You know what? I'm still working through Breath of Fire 3.
Wow. Okay. That's cool, though.
I'm almost done with it, though.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, I hope to write about Stardew Valley, which is RPG-ish. It has dungeon crawling.
I can be hot or cold on dungeon crawling. It really depends.
Well, it has mines where you kill slimes.
Oh, I can deal with that.
And it clearly is based on, like, the Square Enix Chrono Trigger / Final Fantasy VI look.
Oh, well, I can deal with that.
So, yeah, you should definitely get it.
What's it for again?
It's for the PC.
Oh, okay.
So just get it on Steam.
I wonder if my piece of garbage computer can run it. With its
I'm going to go on a limb and say probably.
If it's got like an older retro style to it, it shouldn't be a problem. I run the Ease games without any problems, so.
All right, then. All right, well, Axe of the Blood God is a podcast of US Gamer. You can find us on iTunes, Twitch, Stitcher, and not Twitch yet, but maybe I should. I don't know. You can look at my, like, cluttered-ass office while I record this podcast. But iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever podcasts are sold, subscribe to us, review us, rate us, spread the gospel of RPGs. I would really appreciate it. Check out our streams on Tuesdays and Thursdays and go on YouTube. We're doing another One Hit Wonders this week.
Yes,
we're doing Punch Out.
Yes,
can you spoil me on how far you got, Nadia?
I got up to Great Tiger.
Great Tiger. Okay, well, let's see if I can beat him. I think I can make it to at least Bald Bull.
Yeah, I definitely didn't get that far.
But Bald Bull is, like, pretty tough. Like, Bald Bull is kind of like the, all right, are you ready for an actual challenge now? All right,
yeah.
Let's do this thing, so.
But Great Tiger always gets me with the teleport thingy.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of a pain in the butt. And he, like, he drains you down so far that you can end up losing just by default.
Absolutely.
Like, you almost have no, like, room for error.
Yeah, that's when things start to get real.
All right, well, I'm streaming that in, like, 35 minutes or so.
Good luck.
And so thanks for coming on the show, and thanks to Bob for coming on the show. And until next time, I've been Kat Bailey, and happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser